It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. This morning, we visit the small town of Ona, West Virginia.
Go, 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 go. Not yet. Keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going, go. Now. Okay, that's better.
We'll have that story coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. On last night's episode of The Legislature Today, host Suzanne Higgins spoke with Interim Chancellor of the Higher Education Policy Commission and Chancellor of the West Virginia Community and Technical College System, Dr. Sarah Armstrong Tucker. The two discussed how state-allocated funding for higher education institutions has remained unchanged during this legislative session. And in this excerpt, taped live at the Capitol, they discussed bills the chancellor is watching as the session draws to a close.
I'd like to talk about a couple of the bills that you've been following and supporting. One of them, you know, particularly in this session, we have heard about literally the thousands of children that are living with grandparents or are living with someone other than their custodial parent. And there's a bill that you've been supporting, following, that helps children that are not perhaps with their parents fill out what we call the FAFSA, which is the federal student loan information that needs to be filled out in order to qualify for federal scholarships. Tell us where this bill is and why it is so particularly important for students in West Virginia.
So several months ago, I went and spoke at a high school in Boone County, and I had a conversation with their students about why they needed to go to college. At the end of that conversation, eight students came up to me and told me that they couldn't fill out their FAFSA because they lived in a family structure that wasn't with their biological or adopted parents. And that
because they ask about your financial income,
yes,
your parents,
yes,
what they make, and they're trying to determine your need.
Correct.
And that becomes very difficult when you don't know where your parents are.
Have access to your parents' financial information. And if you're, let's say you're living with your grandparents, if your grandparents haven't done anything to legally take responsibility for you, either custody or guardianship or adoption or whatever, the federal government won't count their W-2s in completing your FAFSA. So what we're finding is that we have this whole generation of students who's growing up who don't have their parents' info, and the federal government does not consider them financially independent until they're 24. So they will not be able to fill out a FAFSA until they're 24 years old. And there are some exceptions to that and some ways to get around it. And I would urge anybody who is in this situation and listening to what I'm saying right now, please contact the college that your child or that you are interested in going to, and the college can help you get a waiver. But it also precludes them from getting state aid, because a lot of our state aid is dependent upon filing the FAFSA. West Virginia Invest, Promise, the Higher Education Grant Program, HEAPS. So Chairwoman Rowan proposed a bill that would help us have permission to get around some of those requirements so that we have some wiggle room for our students.
And where is that bill, do you know?
I believe it is on second read right now, but
It's coming down to the wire.
Yep.
And there's another bill that you've been following that would establish a council for college attainment. What is that? Why is that needed?
Sure. So West Virginia is one of a few states in the country that doesn't actually have a post-secondary attainment goal that has been codified. And we think that that's important. We think that it's important that people know that our residents need to get education and training beyond high school. We know that our workforce by 2030 will require at least 60% of our residents to have post-secondary training. Only 34% of our residents do. Mm-hmm. And so we need to do something to get on this issue to make sure that we're able to sustain our workforce.
That was Interim Chancellor of the Higher Education Policy Commission and Chancellor of the West Virginia Community and Technical College System, Dr. Sarah Armstrong Tucker, speaking with Suzanne Higgins on The Legislature Today. To hear the full interview, visit our website at wvpublic.org. And now let's take a moment to hear from some students in West Virginia. As part of a storytelling mentoring initiative with West Virginia Public Broadcasting, members of our newsroom have been meeting with high school students at the Fayette Institute of Technology. Students there have been exploring issues important to them, including the constantly asked questions they get about what they plan to do after school. They recorded interviews with their peers about how this question makes them feel. Here are some of those voices.
What do you want to do after high school?
I'm going to be a wildlife biologist. I'm going to be going to college at Glenville State. And then I'm going to head out to Colorado and Montana and then study animals.
Well, I'm planning on going and enlisting into the Air Guard. After I do my basic training, I'm planning on getting my bachelor's degree and then becoming a federal park ranger.
Either want to be in the Army and be a light wheel mechanic or just be a light wheel mechanic.
Well, I actually plan on going to WVU Tech in Beckley and go into Health Services Administration just to see if I can kind of be like a secretary in a hospital.
I'm going to 2 years at Bridge Valley and then 2 years at West Virginia Tech for civil engineering.
Do you ever get annoyed when people ask what you're going to do after high school?
Sometimes, because it's my life, man. I'll do what I want to do, and you do what you do.
I feel pretty good whenever people ask me about it, because engineers make a lot of money.
Some people say it's intruding, but other than that, I mean, I don't mind when people ask me. I like telling them.
I feel okay because I know that they're just wondering, so I just tell them.
I feel like very confident with it because I'm very excited about my future. And whenever someone asks me, I always want to tell them, like, make myself sound really good so they have a good, like, impression of me.
Those were the voices of high school students in Fayette County, Jack Ellis, Courtney Casey, Kaylee Whitlow, Rose Gayhart, Preston Gilbert, Kirsten Williams, Dylan Buckland, and Chase Dixon. That story was reported and produced by the Fayette Institute of Technology media class students, Ashton Huffman, Timothy Ellison, Dayton Copeland, and Stormy Surface. They are learning radio storytelling through a project with Inside Appalachia. We'll be hearing more of their work later this year. In the early 1960s, short track racing put Ona, West Virginia on the map as West Virginia's first and only oval asphalt racetrack. The Ona Speedway has been at the epicenter of regional racing culture. The road has been bumpy at times, and the track has survived its fair share of challenges and changes. Yet what hasn't changed is that year after year, many families return to race, watch, and impart their hard-earned wisdom to the community's upcoming generations of drivers. Reporter Lexi Browning recently spent some time with one of those families, the Siglers, and brings us this story.
Ona, West Virginia is a town with two stoplights, but it's also a place where legends are made.
Go, 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 go. Not yet. Keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going, go. Now. Okay, that's better.
That's Greg Sigler. Yeah, he's been racing at Ona Speedway for nearly two decades, but today he's coaching his 15-year-old son, Cole, from the sidelines, using a headset that lets them talk back and forth.
Keep the momentum. Keep coming. You're doing fine.
Cole, who drives a white 2006 Cobalt sporting the number 99, has just embarked on his own racing career. It's his first time behind the wheel of a car.
You're doing good.
For the Sicklers, days at the Ona Speedway are a family affair. Cole's mother, Michael Ann, is there too. She says racing has brought the father and son closer together.
They didn't really have a whole lot in common, and now that they're racing, they talk a lot. They stay gone late at night working on cars. It's really made his dad proud of him.
Between practice sessions and races, Greg, Cole, and Michael Ann often spend long days together at the Speedway, but she doesn't mind.
It's just real family-oriented, and I like that about it.
Out on the track, Cole's cautious, but he's gaining confidence. He's easing into turns and leaning harder into the accelerator. After a few more laps, he pulls over for a tune-up, and his crew guides him to a trailer, which serves as their makeshift pit.
Hey, shut it off for a second.
It's a routine check for safety. The guys check the tires, add air, and tighten a few bolts. Greg gives the green light, and with that, the Cobalt and Cole are ready to return to the track.
Fire it up.
Man, that's a nice car, isn't it?
Yep.
It's not just blood relations who come together here. The track is the center of the racing community that Michael Land describes as, quote, one big family. Marshall Herring agrees. He's been coming here since the track opened, first as a spectator, then as a driver, promoter, and flagger. Now, at 71, he's seen his fair share of tracks.
I raced at Ona back in the 60s, and then I moved to Florida. I raced at Palm Beach Fairgrounds Speedway, Hialeah Speedway, Hollywood Speedway.
But the Ona Speedway is home, and there's no place he'd rather be. When it opened in August 1963, it could seat 16,000 spectators, and it was slated to become a NASCAR track. The Speedway hosted four NASCAR races, bringing in big names like Richard Petty and Bobby Allison to the tiny town.
People actually bought stocks in Ona Speedway. Back then, they were going to build this track and make it a big thing. There was the track that's there now was the original track that they built, but it was laid out for an even bigger track around the outside of it to run the NASCAR cars on.
NASCAR racing traces its roots to the Prohibition era, when quick getaways were a necessity for moonshiners in the hills of Appalachia. Souped-up engines became a way for moonshiners to deliver their products and outrun any lawmen they encountered. By the 50s, the sport was gaining traction and fans across the United States, and Ona was right there at the center of it.
It was unbelievable. I mean, I remember going there when I was young as a kid, when they ran the NASCAR track, where the airport is now, and all that whole bottom land was nothing but cars. There was people up in the trees on the hillside. It was unbelievable, the people that came to watch the NASCAR races at that track.
The rural roads made it difficult for NASCAR's massive car hauling trailers to access the track. The speedway was only a half mile from the nearest stretch of interstate, but without any off-ramps to accommodate the trailers, the NASCAR races eventually stopped. After a 22-year hiatus, a local family reopened the freshly paved track in 1995. By then, its seating capacity had shrunk from 16,000 to 5,000, reflecting racing's new realities.
People kind of died off from it, and the track doesn't bring the crowds in like they used to. None of them do. It's hard to bring a crowd into a racetrack and charge somebody to come and watch a race, even though they might want to watch it, and it's a show that they're getting, and it's well worth the money. But it's hard to get people to do that because of television. That's been a big factor in the short track racing.
Over the last few years, though, Marshall said things have started looking up thanks to new owners. Both attendance and car counts are up. He says it reminds him of the old days.
They're running things pretty much the way it should be, and I see the track coming back a little bit, and I hope it continues to. I would love to see that place packed full of people the way it used to be, the way all the tracks used to be.
Marshall says the key is leveling the playing field to make the sport more accessible to younger folks and those with lower incomes.
The little guy wants to race just like the big guy. And if you got a big guy that's got $1 million a year to bank to race with versus a guy that races out of his pocket from week to week and has to do without a loaf of bread maybe to get a bolt or a tire or something for his car so he can race, there's a big difference there.
Scouring junkyards for used parts or bartering with other drivers can help lower costs of restoring and maintaining the modified stock cars, which can be classified as late models, hobby stocks, and classics. So can swapping out metal bumpers with cheaper plastics. But the best way to get involved, says Marshall, is to simply start by showing up and helping out at the track and in the garage, like Cole did.
He started coming up here to the shop with his dad some, and I would tease him and say, we're going to put you in one of these cars next year. And he got to where he was working on the cars a little bit and helping us. And I think it's great. And I think we need more kids doing stuff like that.
All right, this lap right here, listen to me.
It's been a few hours, and Cole's finishing out his final set of laps. The setting sun marks the end of practice, so he pulls off the track, parks, and gets out. Driving, he found out today, isn't as hard as it seems.
Honestly, it feels like you're being pushed. It feels like everything's getting pushed to one side. But you know, I couldn't ask for anything better. This is probably the best track for starting off.
Greg walks over to congratulate his son on a job well done.
You did it! Look at you. You're like a professional racer.
The race cars are loaded and the trailer doors are closed. With that, the Siglers head home, eager to cross the next finish line. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Lexi Browning in Ona, West Virginia.
That story was part of the Inside Appalachia Folkways Reporting Project and was on a recent episode. To hear this story and more stories of folklife, arts, and Appalachian culture, subscribe to the podcast. Find it at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director and producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.